every little thing we do. We do it for you. That's right, you. We make radio with you in mind and are so, so grateful that you're there listening to CJSF. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Speak up. You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
We are CJSF, and my name is Vivian, and today I have a special guest. I have Dr. Caitlin Mudry. Is this how you pronounce your name? Mudry. And could you introduce yourself to the listeners, and yeah, what are you doing here in BC?
For sure. I'm a naturopathic doctor, and I do a lot of primary care for my patients in Kimberley, BC. I also am a new mom. So I have a five-month-old baby, and that has been a super fun and exciting journey, and we are very happy to be raising our baby in beautiful BC, hiking and biking and all the fun things.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations to the baby.
Thank you.
You are a part of the Access BC team, and what is Access BC, and what is their mission?
For sure. So Access BC is a campaign that has successfully succeeded in getting prescription contraception covered by the government of BC as a gender equity health initiative. And the campaign is 7 years old, and I've been working with them for the past 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And you just said that you are a postdoctoral research fellow, and can you tell me a little bit more about your own research? So what do you do?
For sure. So I do lots of just like general primary care medicine. So that would be with your family doctor. I do a lot of PAPs and things like that. And I also did my training in the States. So It's kind of funny. What brought me to Access BC was that I got my IUD at Planned Parenthood in the United States in like 2011 or something like that. And then when I got back up here, people were like, oh, you know, like, where did you get your ID? And I was like, I don't know. I got mine for free in Planned Parenthood in America. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, we don't have something like that. Like, we have options for sexual health here, which is, like, great in a lot of ways. But especially in my community that I work in, they're open only 3 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
So any kind of, like, sexual health, contraception, consultation, support, questions, access, all of that is something that is desperately needed in multiple municipalities throughout Canada, but especially in BC. And so that's something that like really drew me to this cause was helping support Access. And that's how Access BC started, actually, was when there was a big cut to funding of Planned Parenthood in the States.
Mm-hmm.
In Canada, we were like, oh my gosh, like, what can we do to help support Planned Parenthood? It was like, whoa, wait, we don't even have things like Planned Parenthood in Canada, and we need to be improving our options for contraception care in Canada, as well as supporting our, folks in the States as well.
Mm-hmm. So can you explain how the law was before for providing birth control?
What was going on before was that vasectomies were covered, and mm-hmm. that was it. I used to make a joke of, like, why aren't people getting more vasectomies? It's the only covered prescription contraception.
Yeah.
And so now, starting 2 days ago, April 1st, people can go to their doctor, get a prescription written. So this is for any kind of, like, the birth control pill, mm-hmm. both types of IUDs, the hormonal and the copper IUD. Injections are covered, I believe. There's a couple things that aren't covered, but for most types of contraception that you need a prescription for, you just go to your doctor, get your prescription, and then you go to the pharmacy, and the pharmacy gives you your medication, and it mm-hmm. just gets directly billed to the government. So there's no cost to anybody accessing that contraception up front at the pharmacy, which is amazing. It even covers Plan B, which is super important.
Oh, wow. That is amazing. It's great. And what isn't covered?
So the rings aren't covered, like the NuvaRing. Ring.
Mm-hmm.
Patches aren't covered. And then some types of oral contraception, like Lolo, so those are kind of like these like mini pills.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that the campaign is still working on for sure. So if you go to our website, accessbc.org, we still have a letter writing campaign. So part of our letter writing campaign is a thank you to all of the MLAs and people who have like brought this up to the government, who helped it get passed as a policy. Thank you so much. This is so amazing. Let's keep working on these other couple things, because for some people it is still a really important option. And that's something that I've seen a lot, like as a clinician, is that finding the right birth control for someone can kind of be a difficult process. So when you find something that works for you, you really want to be able to stick with it. And that means like it's effective for you, and it has low side effects, and it works with your body, you can remember to take it.
Oh yeah, for sure. And can you tell me, why did you want to change this law, or why did AccessBC wanted to change this law? So why it is important to change this law? What do you think?
For sure. So like one of the biggest things that we think of is health and gender equality, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, vasectomies were covered. It's probably because they were a surgical procedure, and most surgical procedures are covered. But when we think about that, of like what's the percentage of people who are accessing contraception and what percentage of them are people who would be getting a vasectomy, it's very, very low, right? So the current thing that we had in place was like very inequitable to anyone with a uterus needing contraception. And then also our we have like a huge white paper on our website. It's still up there, but just showing that there is tons of financial benefits to the government when contraception is paid for, because it helps prevent unwanted pregnancies. Having contraception helps with a lot of different gynecological conditions. It's actually like one of the largest prescribed things is like, oh, you have something going on, like why don't you try an IUD, why don't you try going back on the pill. It's a huge treatment for any kind of gynecological or uterine difficulty. And then it the campaign is all about bringing awareness to gender equity and access to gendered issues in healthcare. And that's one of the biggest things I saw when I was campaigning for the campaign and like talking to people, is I would say, did you know that these things aren't covered? Did you know that only the vasectomies are covered? And people would be shocked. They'd be like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. Like every single person in their lives that they knew who had a uterus was on birth control, and nobody knew that they had to be paying for it.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. And where do you see the biggest inequalities when it comes to healthcare in BC? Still,
I mean, it's still in all of our like marginalized populations, and so like women, non-binary folk, trans folk, people of color. In my practice personally, I think a lot of it is the like the younger populations who are trying to navigate their way through a healthcare system. So like younger, lower income, there is all of these different systems put in place, but they are really hard to navigate. And again, that was something that through the campaign, people were like, oh, part of this contraception is covered under this kind of program, but to be able to get the funding for it, you had to go through all of these like different windows. I would even call pharmacists and be like, hey, how do you help someone sign up for this like PharmaNet program that helps pay for this? And the pharmacist like didn't even have an idea. So that's something where I feel like often policies get made, but they're not thinking of the people when they do get made, and then the politicians themselves are not that vulnerable population, and they don't have to go through it.
Yeah.
So something that's really amazing about this new policy is that it's pretty, as far as everything has been laid out, I haven't had to go get a new IUD yet, but as far as it sounds, you just go to the pharmacy and then you access your contraception, which is a very simple, very accessible. Kudos to the people that made it so easy for all of our vulnerable populations to access this medicine.
Yeah, very easy and also very, very important. And how did you or AccessBC achieve the final step or the final change? How did you get involved with the government, and how did you achieve the new law?
For sure. I think a lot of it was just like determination. So in in 2020, this policy was mentioned in a lot of campaign promises, and then nothing kind of happened. And so I remember a couple budgets ago being like, oh my gosh, is it going to come out in the budget? And we were all so excited, and then it didn't. We were like, oh, okay, here we go, more work. And so the entire campaign has really just been like a grassroots campaign of getting people to write and contact their MLAs, getting cities on board. That's something that I was really a part of before I got pregnant and had my baby and was a little bit busy. But we got all of the local municipalities, we got like almost every single municipality across BC to endorse our policies, so that they were telling the government, like, we as the city of Kimberley, we as the city of, you know, Burnie or Burnaby or wherever, think that this is an important policy. So we had pressure not just from the people, but from all of these different kind of like levels of government, showing the provincial government that this was something that mattered to every single person in every single municipality in BC.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I see that. And how will universal free contraception impact the issues of period poverty?
Yeah, so for a lot of people, when they are on certain kinds of contraception, they don't get a period, which is amazing for period poverty concerns. And I think just creating awareness of, like, your menses matters, you know, like, what the symptoms that you have while you're on your menses and how we treat them matters, as well as how we access things to help treat our menses. And so if we're taking medicines that are making our menses more manageable, that is helping with our bleeding, that's going to mean that we need less materials for our period. And then also we're going to be saving on the medication, so we can take all of that medication savings and be putting it into these still way too expensive period products that we need, you know?
Yeah. Okay, I can understand that totally, and it makes a huge change. So I'm from Germany, and period products are so expensive, so I wish that we had the same law too. So I hope there will be a change soon. So it is great what you have done so far, and I wish for that, like, that more countries would do that too. And how will it influence our female future in general? So how does it influence our whole future? So if you look, like, I don't know, like 3 years ahead, how does it, like, influence our future?
I think a lot of people are going to feel, like, a lot more supported by their healthcare systems and supported by their government. I'm trying really hard not to cry because it's, like, such an emotional issue, but, like, sorry.
Take your time. It's okay. It is great.
It was really amazing to see our government do something positive that we've been working towards for so long. Like, over the past couple of years, especially in BC politics, like, there's so many things that we can get frustrated at our government for. There's so many things that can make us upset. Working in healthcare, like, healthcare has been very tough over the past couple of years since 2020, if you know what I mean. Like, and then seeing like politicians listening to the words of all of these advocates, like, there's people of every different profession and background and everything in the Access BC team, and we all knew that this was such an important issue, and so having it, like, come to fruition is like, oh my gosh, we made a difference, and it's going to impact people immediately every single day. Every single day that somebody goes to pick up their free contraception, they're going to be so thankful that they have access to that contraception, and that they're saving money, and that their government values them, and that their government, like, understands the importance of this for, like, women's health and for uterine health. It's a huge deal.
It is, for sure. And you can be so proud of yourself that you and Access BC did this amazing change, and everybody will be so thankful, and everybody will think of you every day and be thankful for you. So you can be really proud, and I'm so grateful that you let out of these emotions, and that you can share what you feel about it, because it is so, so important, and it is, for sure, it just so shows us how, like, we still have so much to work on, but it is a huge step in the right direction, and it's the first, like, I read an article about it, so the first time I heard about it, and I was so grateful, and it's such a great opportunity, so you can be really proud of yourself. And yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks so much.
So, would you like to add anything as we almost close out here for today's interview so far?
Yeah, so there is campaigns in almost every single province. And the Yukon, yeah, there's campaigns in a bunch of different provinces to help those provinces get similar policies to what we just achieved here in BC. There's a bunch of political parties in Alberta, Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec, Nova Scotia, and the Yukon that have made commitments, like, what's that, campaign commitments, to implement universal free contraception coverage should they be elected. So looking into all of those parties, helping support the rest of these grassroots campaigns so that we can make this like a Canada-wide policy and have this be something that Canada is like, BC's leading Canada right now, and Canada could be leading, you know, like a good part of the world. We don't always have like the best healthcare policies for everything, but this is something that we can like really be taking a huge step towards all across Canada. So I really encourage people to check that out. It's all on our website. If you go to the Access BC Media, in our press release, there's links to all of the different campaigns that we need to keep continue supporting. And also, while you're on your website, sending that thank you letter, like I mentioned, that thank you letter to our politicians, and then also encouraging them to consider including the patch, the ring, and some of our like low OCP choices.
And if you want to look for their website, you should definitely check out our archives. I will also link the Access BC website on our intravenous archive, so you should definitely check that out. Do you also have other social media web like pages that people can check out?
We have social media on Facebook, so it's Access BC on Facebook, and that's where I think we do most of our posting and links, and we keep our website really up to date as well, so like most of our media stuff will be up on the website as well.
So you should definitely check out too, and also on our archive on Intravenous. And now to my very last question, so why do you think free access to birth control is so important for our society?
Because 50% of our population needs it, man. Like, that's a lot of our population, right? And when a big thing is that when studies show that when women and people with uteruses have access to the things that we need to take control of our health, we are able to do everything that we want to do. We're able to participate, we're able to have children, we're able to have children and participate and just be engaged in every single aspect of, like, life, academia, like the economy, all of these different kinds of things, because birth control is a human right, and our reproductive system is one of the biggest systems in our entire body, and every single piece of our entire body affects how we're able to like function in this world. So by supporting access to contraception, we're supporting access to like fully functioning women and people with uteruses, which is super important.
For sure. And yeah, thank you so much for answering all of these questions and for opening up about the free birth control and the new law. And yeah, thank you so, so much. And I have one last question. What's your favorite song, or what do you have a song that's like inspiring or kind of fits to today's topic that you want me to play on air for you?
Oh my gosh, I don't even know. It'd probably be something my blog. Been listening to a lot of Blondie recently in our house. It's like a new baby, a new baby girl to add to like our feminist crew. So anything by Blondie, I think, would be my request.
Blondie, okay. Okay, for sure. I will definitely play the song, and then we can listen to it right after this interview. And yeah, thank you so much, Caitlin, for being here. And
this is Bird Note. Enormous white birds soar gracefully in close formation against an azure sky, wingtip to wingtip. Circling ever higher toward a scattering of clouds, these giants have as long a wingspan as any birds on the continent. Are they eagles? Vultures? Cranes? They are American white pelicans. Spread wide, their wings measure a full 9 feet tip to tip, nearly that of the California condor. American white pelicans seem to drift without effort on updrafts. They glisten snowy white, except for their black flight feathers. When standing on a sandbar, American white pelicans look ponderous, Their comically oversized yellow-orange beaks are a near match to their huge orange feet. They simply dwarf any brown pelicans alongside, standing a full head taller. In summer, these birds breed mainly in the interior west of the United States and Canada. They favor shallow portions of large lakes, marshes, and rivers, where they scoop fish from the water in the pouches of their beaks. Loads of fish, because a pelican chick may eat 150 pounds worth before it leaves the nest. See photos and videos of American white pelicans when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Hey, listener. It's awesome that you are here on the other end of the radio. You are why we are here. A radio station is nothing without listeners. Thank you for being here for us at CJSF 90.1 FM.
With frightening clown sightings sweeping social media and terrorizing high school students and communities across North America, it is good to remember that clowns have always been with us and can be found in one form or another in every culture. Julia Lane is a clown and is doing her PhD in education at SFU on clowning. There's a lot more to clowning and the rich traditions and practice of clowning than just scaring us or making us laugh. So I'm here with Julia Lane, and you're doing graduate work on clowning.
I am.
So clowns and clowning aren't exactly what I think most people think of when they think of academia and you know, high-level research. How does clowning fit into what you're doing?
Well, the approach to clowning that I have taken and the way that my training, my clown training as a performer has gone is that clowning really draws on who you are as a person. So part of who I am as a person is a scholar, and part of who I am as a person is a clown. And your approach to clowning can come from anything. So might not be the first thing you think of when you think of academia, might not be the first thing you think of when you think of even stage performance, might not be the first thing you think of when you think of teaching, but it can fit in any of those places. And that's a big part of what my research is about, is looking at this particular approach to clowning and what we can pull out of it as applications for other places in life and other kinds of work and other kinds of thought processes.
So I think probably most people would think of clowning as something primarily as a kind of performance. Mm-hmm. But is there more to it than that?
Yes and no. So the training that I've done, clowns exist in nearly every human culture in nearly every era, something that can be called clown. Whether or not it should rightfully be called clown is another question, but some kind of clown-esque tradition exists across all of these times and places. So it's very hard to be specific about what we mean when we talk about it. So in order to get specific right now, what I will focus on is the training I've done, which is a performance training.
Right.
It is primarily oriented towards performance on stage. However, there are aspects of that approach to clowning that I really believe can be drawn out and applied to so many other different pursuits and so many other different ideas, because it really is about discovering something in yourself and celebrating it and bringing it forward and being honest about those things. One of the rules of clown is be honest. So that is part of what I think can be applied in the academic context, even though it does come from a performance tradition.
So can you give me an example of that?
Absolutely. One example, the first one that comes to my mind, is another one of the rules of clowning is follow the impulse.
Right.
So often in the academic context, often in the teaching context, we think about the plans that we make. What's the curriculum? What's the thing I have to teach today? What's the thing I have to do? What's the proposal for my research? How do I make sure I'm meeting these milestones? It's all about the planning. And maybe this is why people don't think of clowning when they think of academia, because they think of academia as something very serious and structured. But that's only one way of doing academia, and other ways of doing academia abound, and we can follow our impulse when we teach. We can follow our impulse when we write. We can follow our impulse when we research, and we do all the time. People have to. So part of my work is really just saying, look, here's these things we already do. This just gives us another language to talk about it and to really celebrate it as one of the ways that we actually already operate in the academy.
Right. So I guess one of the things that people, I think the popular conception from what you would see on TV or movies or some other forms of media is that clowning is just sort of silly and frivolous and fun.
Mm-hmm.
But there are really, I mean, the way you approach clowning, that's kind of a misconception. And there are a lot of misconceptions about what clowning is.
Yeah, so there are, in some ways you could call them misconceptions, you could also just call them conceptions, and again, the multiplicity of what it means to clown, what clowns are, means that, you know, yes, clown is silly, yes, clown can be frivolous, yes, clown can be serious, yes, clown can be tragic, yes, the clown can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's not bound, and this is one of the major parts of my research, is about where the clown can allow us to be unbounded. We are bound in our daily lives by rules and traditions and norms and laws, and those things are good and important, and I'm not saying we should get rid of them, but the clown, one of the things that often transcends across all of these different traditions of clown is that the clown is the figure that can loosen those reins a bit, that right. can play, that can get silly. And sometimes that silliness is incredibly serious. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're being silly on the surface and they're making jokes and they're falling over and they're, you know, but clowning has started revolutions. It's been incredibly integral to revolutions in the Russian context right. and in other places in the world. So don't be fooled by the silliness, I guess is what I would say, is that one of the things that clowns try to challenge us to see is that silly and serious are not opposites.